This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January 25th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, tens of thousands fill Egypt's Tahrir Square on the anniversary of the uprising that drove Hosni Mubarak from power. We'll hear from Egyptians about the progress and setbacks of the revolution and what's ahead. In Southeast Asia, Indonesian fishermen are losing their boats and livelihoods as Australia enforces heavy penalties in disputed waters. And following the president's State of the Union, environmentalists question his plans for domestic energy production while Republicans try to push forward the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. U.S. Special Forces have freed two hostages from Somali pirates. The two aid workers with the Danish Refugee Council, one a U.S. citizen, were kidnapped last October while doing landmine removal work. Media reports that SEAL Team 6, the same unit responsible for killing Osama bin Laden, killed at least eight of the kidnappers at their outdoor camp. A Somali pirate told the AP that at the time of the attack, the guards were sleeping after chewing a local narcotic. Salvage efforts continue on the cruise ship Costa Concordia off the Italian coast. So far, 16 bodies have been recovered from the wreckage, and many more passengers are still missing. The New York Times reports that workers have sighted the first contaminant slick on the water surface, but have not yet identified the substance. Officials say oil-capturing booms around the wreck were containing the liquid. The operation to remove fuel from the ship's tank began yesterday, but the actual pumping isn't expected to start until this weekend. Relations between France and Turkey are hovering near the breaking point after the French Senate passed a bill that outlaws denial of the Armenian genocide. The mass killing took place nearly 100 years ago. For FSRN, Clea Calcutt reports from France.
Turkish Prime Minister Recep Erdogan said the bill passed Monday by the French Senate is racist. The bill makes it a crime to deny the Ottoman Turks committed genocide against Armenians during World War I. Armenia says up to 1.5 million people were killed in 1915, a claim Turkey has always denied. The bill passed the Senate 127-86, a vote Armenia described as historic. The vote puts denying the Armenian genocide on a legal par with denying the World War II Holocaust, which is also a crime in France. Turkey has warned retaliation would be gradual and is putting off sanctions until the bill is passed into law. That step is expected in the coming weeks. In France, the bill has also been controversial. Many have accused French President Nicolas Sarkozy of supporting the bill in a bid to woo Armenian voters ahead of elections in April. Clea Calcutt, FSRN, Paris.
More than 7,000 inmates in Kyrgyzstan are on hunger strike, protesting poor prison conditions. About 1,300 of those prisoners have gone a step further and have sewed their mouths shut, according to the BBC. The protest follows a prison riot last week that left one inmate dead. A Canadian provincial Supreme Court has sentenced the owner of a demolition company in British Columbia to 60 days in jail for repeatedly exposing employees to asbestos. A lawyer involved in the case says it's the first time in a quarter century the province has given a jail sentence in a worker safety case. FSRN's Lillian Bachter reports.
Every year in British Columbia, at least 50 people die because of past exposure to asbestos. This did not stop Canadian contractor Arthur Moore from knowingly exposing his workers to the deadly substance. His young employees, some teenagers, came from alcohol and drug recovery centers. Moore falsified documents claiming the demolition sites were asbestos-free and did not provide training or protective equipment to workers. Lee Loftus is the president of the BC and Yukon Building and Construction Trades Council.
I was talking to one of the young ladies today outside the courtroom, and she says she recalls taking drywall off and her nose was packed with drywall dust.
Moore's business was initially caught for worker safety violations, but he did not obey the orders to improve conditions. Loftus says he's disappointed with Moore's non-criminal sentence of only 60 days.
We just can't believe that this person gets 60 days while these workers, and there's over 60 workers that were exposed, have have a lifetime of being uncertain. Will I die or when do I die?
Leftis says he is hopeful that the ruling sends a message to other contractors who are not complying with worker safety laws. Lillian Bachter, FSRN, Canada.
And finally, new figures from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission show the agency received a record number of employment discrimination claims in 2011. There were nearly 100,000 private sector complaints filed. It's the second record year in a row for the EEOC. Discrimination based on race and sex remain the most prominent charges, but the instances of both of these fell between 2010 and 2011. Claims based on religion, national origin, age, and disability all rose slightly. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. 1 year ago today, massive protests took place across Egypt in what became known as the January 25th Revolution. In Cairo, marchers made their way to Tahrir Square, which became the center of the uprising. The protests on January 25, 2011 were the start of an 18-day-long uprising that spread throughout the country and eventually forced the ouster of former President Hosni Mubarak. Today, activists returned to Tahrir Square, where some celebrated the country's accomplishments and some criticized the continued rule of military leaders. FSRN's Noel King reports from Cairo.
Tens of thousands of Egyptians poured into Cairo's Tahrir Square on Wednesday in celebrations that combined pride and jubilation with reverence and some pessimism. Crowds began arriving overnight, and by noon, streams of Egyptians poured into the square from all directions. Egyptian political parties and activist groups set up tents throughout the square, and party leaders and activists stood on platforms, leading dueling songs and speeches. By late morning, the square was a sea of waving Egyptian flags, and the crowd, which included Egyptians of all ages, was packed in tight. Mohammed Abdel Shafi, a farmer from the town of Fayoum who traveled to Tahrir Square to attend the celebration, expressed a mix of pride at the revolution's success in toppling Hosni Mubarak and frustration with Egypt's slow transition to democracy.
I'm here to celebrate, yes, but it's not only a celebration. We still want the military council to hand over power to civilians.
It was a common sentiment. Egypt has been governed by a council of high-ranking military officers since Mubarak stepped down in February of last year. The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or SCAF, has broad support among many Egyptians. But pro-democracy activists charge that the council employs repressive and sometimes violent tactics that are reminiscent of Mubarak's iron-fisted rule. Many of those celebrating said they had faith in Egypt's new parliament, which was sworn in this week and ushered in a new crop of lawmakers, many of them representing Islamist parties. 17-year-old Isra told FSRN that she first went to Tahrir Square last year, toward the end of Egypt's 18-day uprising. On Wednesday, she was proud to be back in the square and thrilled by the recent electoral success of the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party. Overall, she said, she is happy with the direction Egypt has taken.
I'm glad that things are better now for women. We have more of an opportunity to play a role in society, politics, and culture.
But Adel Hamid, a furniture maker from Cairo, disagreed. The elderly man pulled a tattered newspaper from a plastic folder and displayed a faded front page photo of last year's marches in Tahrir. He pointed to himself in the photo and said, Egypt hasn't come far enough since he and millions of others marched last year.
The Egyptian people are starving while the government pays half a million Egyptian pounds to feed Mubarak and keep him in a cage.
Crowds are expected to remain in Tahrir through the evening. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
When Egyptians took to the streets of Cairo last year, marchers made their way through police barricades and past the institutions of power, such as government buildings and political party headquarters. Hour by hour, the crowds grew until thousands filled Tahrir Square. On the march through the city, journalist Aya Batraoui was there.
I'm standing here in a protest that has turned into a march of thousands of people, young and old, rich and poor, men and women, religious and secular. They are taking to the streets today on January 25th for what has been called the Day of Revolution, the Day of Change.
During the following months, Aya reported for FSRN on the revolution, bringing us stories of police cracking down on protesters, women calling for a stronger voice in shaping government and civil society, and youth pushing back against military trials and detention. She joins us now from Cairo, where she's been monitoring today's events as well. Aya, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
As we heard in the previous report, 1 year later, there are different views about how far Egypt has come and where it is headed. What have you been hearing 1 year later as you're there in Tahrir Square?
I've been hearing in Tahrir Square the same thing I heard exactly 1 year ago today, which is that people are demanding the downfall of the regime. People feel that Mubarak was ousted, that his regime is intact, and that is because the military council which took power after Mubarak was ousted is the same military council that served under him, and it is led by the same military ruler who was his defense minister for 20 years. They are saying that their calls for freedom, democracy, and social equality has not come true. They're saying that the military has yet to prove its words which say that they are behind the revolution. They're saying that if the military was truly behind the revolution, 100 protesters would not have died in clashes with security forces since the military council took power. And they're saying that till today, only one police officer has been found guilty, and he was tried in absentia. And upon his return to Cairo, he was given a retrial.
Last year in Tahrir Square, you spoke to a number of people who were involved in the protest. One of them was a young woman named Sarah Abdel Rahman.
This is the first time that I join a protest or go down in the streets or do anything like that in my life. And it's really working. There's so many people here and it's so safe. Everyone I know, I didn't even know that they were coming. And they showed up and this is just amazing.
Have you ever seen anything like this before?
No, probably just in a football match or something. But this time it's real. So.
What is the one thing you want to see?
A free country, democracy, something, change, any kind of change. You know, presidents have gone and come back and we still have the same guy, so maybe some change would be nice.
That's Sarah Abdel Rahman speaking 1 year ago in Tahrir Square. Your thoughts about the sentiments she expresses and what that means today?
You know, it's really ironic because a year later, the same demand that Sarah stood in Tahrir Square calling for is the same demand people are asking for today. They're saying that democracy is not just about elections. Democracy means changing the old system that was in place for so long. It means bringing people to justice. It means that everyone falls under the jurisdiction of the law and that no entity has more power than another, which includes the military rulers who have ruled this country for over 60 years. And so people are calling for the same thing. And they're saying that there have been changes, but not enough, not what all these people have gone out into the streets for. And so essentially people today are saying, this is not a day of celebration. This is a day to continue the revolution that they started 1 year ago. And they're planning on staying in the square until those demands are met and until the military council makes very clear what kind of jurisdiction they're going to have and what kind of jurisdiction and authority the elected parliament will have in writing the upcoming constitution, in choosing the next president, in removing emergency laws, and all of the other demands that people went out exactly 1 year calling for.
That's journalist Aya Batraoui speaking to us from Cairo on the one-year anniversary of the beginning of the protests in Egypt. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dorian.
In his State of the Union address Tuesday night, President Barack Obama laid out a vision for how he'd like to move the country forward, touching on tax reform, trade, immigration, and job creation. Today we're going to focus on another topic in the speech, the environment and energy production. Although the president made only one passing reference to climate change and avoided the Keystone XL pipeline, he proposed a domestic energy plan that's raising concerns for some environmentalists. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the details in Washington.
The president's 2012 State of the Union address was somewhat of a mixed bag for environmentalists, with promises of industrial efficiency measures and the expansion of wind and solar energy production, coupled with plans to expand offshore oil drilling and the controversial process of extracting natural gas.
The development of natural gas will create jobs and power trucks and factories that are cleaner and cheaper, proving that we don't have to choose between our environment and our economy.
But Emily Worth from Food and Water Watch says natural gas isn't as clean an energy source as its name might suggest.
It does burn cleaner than coal, and that's true. But the issue is that across the country, we have extracted most of the natural gas from what they call conventional sources, where the gas was easy to extract from porous formations. And the new phase or the new era of natural gas extraction is much more dangerous and destructive than the conventional gas development of the past.
A 2008 analysis by ProPublica found more than 1,000 cases of contamination from fracking, documented by courts and state and local governments. Worth cited one case where the chemicals used for fracking made a small town's water undrinkable.
Endemic Pennsylvania, the EPA just intervened for families there and actually agreed to deliver a fresh water source because they looked at test results showing high levels of arsenic, manganese, as well as other synthetic chemicals used in the hydraulic fracturing process.
The EPA announced last week that it will continue testing the water in Dimmock, where residents have accused the Cabot Oil and Gas Corporation of contaminating local wells. Though President Obama promised in the State of the Union address to force companies to disclose which chemicals they use, he called for dramatic expansion of the fracking industry.
We have a supply of natural gas that can last America nearly 100 years. And my administration will take every possible action to safely develop this energy.
The president also advocated for opening up more than 75% of potential offshore oil and gas resources. While he did not mention his decision to deny the permit for TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline, the issue is not going away anytime soon. Early Wednesday morning, the House Subcommittee on Energy and Power held a hearing on the North American Energy Access Act, a bill that would transfer the power to approve the pipeline to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. At the hearing, the State Department's Carrie Ann Jones both defended the decision to deny the Keystone permit and called the new bill irresponsible.
The proposed legislation imposes narrow time constraints and creates automatic mandates that prevent an informed decision. We also feel the legislation raises serious questions about existing legal authorities and appears to override foreign policy and national security considerations implicated by a cross-border permit, which are properly assessed by the State Department.
The North American Energy Access Act is just one of many avenues Republicans are exploring in the continued push to approve the construction of the pipeline, which would carry oil from Canada's tar sands to refineries on the Gulf Coast. House Speaker John Boehner has suggested attaching the issue to the payroll tax bill, and North Dakota Republican John Hoeven is drafting a bill that would give Congress the authority to approve the project. The environmental advocates who organized across the country to oppose Keystone XL have also promised to stay in the fight. On Tuesday, Vermont Democrat Bernie Sanders spoke at a rally on Capitol Hill and told the crowd how he plans to take on the fossil fuel industry's influence in politics.
Congress keeps voting not for the interests of our children, not for the interest of the future, but for the profits of the huge oil companies and the coal companies. Starting now, we have got to end all of the subsidies, all of the tax breaks that go to the oil companies, that go to the coal companies, and I'm going to be introducing legislation to do just that.
The International Climate Organization 350.org, which organized Tuesday's rally, also plans to spend 2012 combating fracking, mountaintop removal coal mining, and any further development of Canada's tar sands. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Indonesian fishermen who are caught in traditional fishing grounds that extend into nearby Australian waters can be charged, fined, and sometimes jailed. It's part of Australia's aggressive approach to managing its maritime borders. The fishermen's boats are burned on the spot, leaving them with huge debts and no way to pay them back. In 2009, more than 1,000 boats were destroyed, according to the Australian government. Now one of the fishermen who claims he was unjustly punished is fighting for justice in a landmark legal case in Australia. FSRN's Rebecca Henschke has the story from Kupang in East Indonesia.
When Indonesian fishermen are out on the water, they often worry about more than just the weather and a small catch. Saring says he watched his own boat burn after Australian authorities apprehended him at sea.
You cannot imagine what that feels like. I wanted to cry, but I couldn't. That boat was the only instrument I had in order to feed and look after my family. It went up in flames instantly because there was lots of petrol on board, but there were some parts of the boat that were still floating. So the Australian Navy shot at them with machine guns till they too went under. I was scared, but what could I do? I was forced to suppress the fear.
Australian officials accused Saring of illegally fishing in Australian waters and put him in detention. But Saring disputes their claims. He pulls out a map that was given to him by the Australian authorities. He points to where he was, clearly on this map, in Indonesian waters.
I was in Indonesian waters. The Australian patrol entered Indonesian waters. We wanted to protest, but they wouldn't have understood us. Before we left, we always look at maps to see where the maritime borders are, and we use GPS when we're at sea. So we know where we are. This was the first time in 15 years of fishing that area that I have met with Australian patrols.
Saring refused to admit to any wrongdoing, unlike others he's known, so Australian officials kept him in detention for nearly 3 months. He was then acquitted of all charges and returned to Indonesia. Saring's case, along with six other fishermen, has been taken up by an Australian lawyer. They're now fighting for compensation for the wrongful burning of their boats and unlawful detention. If Saring wins, it will be the first time compensation has been paid by the Australian government to a traditional Indonesian fisherman.
I want enough money to buy another boat. Here, if you don't have a boat, you're nothing. You can imagine, once I was a person that employed other people. Now I am forced to beg for work on other boats.
Right now, Saring's family is struggling.
Everything is very hard at the moment. We have nothing. Nothing for the school fees. All our hopes and earnings went down with that boat. Now all my husband can do is work on someone else's boat. Before, we earned enough money for our daily needs and enough to send the children to school. Now my oldest has to drop out of school. He should be going to junior high, but we don't have the money for the school fees.
For at least three centuries, fishermen from what is now Indonesia have sailed to Australia's northern shores. But in 1981, Australia was granted control over a large part of the sea between southern Indonesia and northern Australia. The Indonesian government received generous promises of aid in return. But Indonesian fishermen, including Saring's friend, Haji Hafifah, have not seen the benefits of that agreement.
I can't even remember how many times it happened to me. I have had 22 boats confiscated. The first time I was arrested was in 2002. I paid $3,000 and I was allowed to go home. The next time was in 2003. 8 ships were arrested. I couldn't pay to have them all released. I only could pay $4,500, so 6 of them were burnt. Back then, the Indonesian consulate in Darwin told us to admit we were wrong and we would be allowed to go home. But we didn't do anything wrong because we were in Indonesian waters.
They hate Australian governments. Sometimes they think bad things to the Australians, you know. And sad, you know. Why should they been treated inhuman like that, you know? Why didn't they send their boats back to Indonesian waters if they did trespass the border? Why should catch them send them to court and then burn their boat? This is the same thing that they said they kill, you know, the Australian kills their livelihood.
Local lobbyist Ferdi Tonomi works with the Australian consulate in Kupang. Now he fights for the rights of traditional Timorese fishermen.
The Indonesian reps in Darwin especially always persuade them, okay, just admit that you made a mistake, so it's you're wrong, etc. So you can go out the court soon and go home soon. See? This is the, no defending from, there is no protection from the Indonesian government at all.
Adding to their problems, in 2009, this fishing community was devastated by the worst ever oil spill in the Timor Sea. The oil rig, owned and operated by an Australian-based company, leaked uncontrollably for 74 days in the Montano oil field off Western Australia. The spill destroyed fish stocks and seaweed farms in nearby West Timor. Mustafa Astad is the head of the Association of Traditional Fishermen of the Timor Sea.
You could say that this area used to be a fishing paradise. It was the center of the fishing industry in eastern Indonesia. But after the oil spill of 2009, there has been a dramatic decrease in the number of fish, an 80 to 90% decline. I used to have lots of boats, but now I have none. My crew used to go out and then come home empty-handed time and time again. After a while, they got sick of working for me. There was nothing to do. My fishing business was completely destroyed.
The lack of fish has forced some into transporting asylum seekers. Although illegal, fishermen like Mustafa say they have few other options.
There is no choice. If we had a choice, then we wouldn't do it. At the moment, there is no work because of the oil spill and the Australians destroying our boats. We have no choice.
The penalty for illegally transporting migrants to Australia is up to 5 years in prison. But the money is so good that some fishermen say that it would take care of their families for the duration of their time in jail. Meanwhile, Saring waits for the courts to rule on his case. He's hoping a ruling in his favour will send a message to the Australian authorities that they can't continue to attack Indonesian fishermen's rights. Rebecca Henschke, Free Speech Radio News, Kupang, Indonesia.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kamp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.